Cervetti. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, a lecture entitled Adventures of the I, the Poetry of Pronouns.
The I still has tricks up its sleeve, some of them confessional. Quote, I wish I understood myself more clearly or less well. And I know breakthrough as I tell the dream surpassed. Seen alone, I is a lost cause.
University Professor Rosanna Warren on the Poetry of Pronouns tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The four Democratic presidential hopefuls vying for a win in tomorrow's Iowa caucuses are into their final flurry of campaigning. NPR's David Wellness says Massachusetts Senator John Kerry is trying to capitalize on a recent surge in polls in the state.
Kerry definitely has a big momentum this week, and he really does have a kind of charisma that hasn't been seen here that much before. He, by his nature, is not a terribly outgoing person, but he's become very relaxed and spontaneous on the campaign trail and very, very intent on winning those votes one by one. And it's hard for him to tear himself away from any of the rallies. His staff will all be on the bus, and he'll still be talking with potential voters out there. And you can see that he feels that every vote is going to count tomorrow night.
NPR's David Wellna in Iowa. While the focus in the Democratic race is on Iowa, one candidate, retired General Wesley Clark, is concentrating on the next political battleground, New Hampshire. NPR's Nora Rahm reports from Keene, New Hampshire.
A major theme of the Clark campaign is that he's a retired general opposed to war except as a last resort. At a pancake breakfast in Keene in the southwestern part of the state, Clark picked up the endorsement of George McGovern, the 1972 Democratic presidential nominee who ran on an anti-Vietnam War platform. He lost in a landslide to Richard Nixon. McGovern said it's important the Democrats regain the White House this year. He said all the Democrats in the race are good contenders, but Clark is the best of the lot and has the best chance of winning this fall. McGovern said Republicans often claim the Democrats are soft on defense, and that will be hard to do with a four-star general. Nora Rahm, NPR News, Keene, New Hampshire.
At least 20 people were killed and dozens of others were injured today when a suicide bomber blew up a pickup truck loaded with explosives outside the main gate of the U.S. headquarters in Baghdad. NPR's Ann Garrels reports from Baghdad.
The U.S. military says as much as 1,000 pounds of explosives in a Toyota pickup exploded as hundreds of Iraqi workers were waiting to be searched before going to their jobs inside the American compound. Three American contractors and three soldiers were among the wounded, with one soldier saying it's amazing there weren't more casualties among the troops. The barricade of sandbags at the gate took the brunt of the blast. Today's bombing, which could be heard for miles, appeared to be an effort to strike as close as possible at the heart of the American authority. This attack is the deadliest in Iraq's and Saddam Hussein was captured in mid-December. Ann Garrels, NPR News, Baghdad.
Investigators say the bomb threat that forced a Delta Airlines flight to be diverted to Ireland today turned out to be a hoax. The jetliner, which was en route from Frankfurt to Atlanta, made the unscheduled landing after a crew member found a note in a restroom suggesting there was a bomb aboard. This is NPR News from Washington.
Good evening in Boston. I'm Gina Tempesta. Two of New Hampshire's newspapers have endorsed a Democratic presidential hopeful, Bay State Senator John Kerry, while a third has put its support behind Howard Dean. The Telegraph of Nashua and the Concord Monitor today gave Kerry their stamp of approval in today's editions. The Monitor says Kerry has reasoned and solid answers on every issue from foreign policy to domestic policy. The Telegraph also cited Kerry's experience and record. The Keene Sentinel, meanwhile, has endorsed former Vermont Governor Howard Dean. A Roman Catholic priest in Connecticut has been removed from ministry following allegations of sexual abuse of a minor. Those allegations against the Reverend Andrew Brizolara go back to when he served in Boston, reportedly during the 1980s. State education officials are reviewing Holyoke schools to find areas for improvement. Last week, a team from the State Office of Educational Quality and Accountability visited the city school. Superintendent Eduardo Carballo says that he's pleased with the progress. The state declared Holyoke one of two underperforming districts in November. And the Patriots are headed to the Super Bowl. The Pats beat the Colts for the AFC Championship in Foxborough this afternoon, 24-14. It is the second time in 3 years the Pats have taken the title. They will face off against the winner of tonight's NFC game between the Panthers and Eagles going on right now. In the forecast, snow showers tapering off with clearing skies overnight, turning windy and cold with a low of 20. Right now it's 34 in Boston.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, MathWorks.com, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, sponsoring new, small, rigorous high schools around the country that prepare students for college, work, and citizenship, GatesFoundation.org.
Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, we hear a lecture by University Professor Rosanna Warren entitled Adventures of the Eye, the Poetry of Pronouns. This lecture is part of a series of free weekly lectures given throughout the academic year by faculty members from the University Professors Program. Professor Warren is the director of the University Program on Literary Translation, as well as a teacher in the Creative Writing Program. She is also an award-winning poet. Her most recent book of poems is entitled Departure from Norton Press. Professor Warren.
Almost at the end of his book-length poem, The Triumph of Love, Geoffrey Hill mentions a poem by the 19th-century Italian poet Leopardi, A se stesso, to oneself. Quote, a se stesso, of self, the lost cause to end all lost causes, and which you are not, are you, so hopeless as to hope to defend? You've what? I want to examine today some structures of poetic selfhood. In choosing the poetry of Geoffrey Hill, I put out of my mind the fact that he is a colleague of mine at Boston University and possibly a teacher of yours. For my subject, The Poetry of Pronouns, I can't help but choose his poetry, as it dramatizes poetic selfhood more strenuously than any other contemporary poems I know. In a talk on personhood and impersonality, let me say at the outset that I intend this as a strictly impersonal exercise. Listen again to these lines. A se stesso, of self, the lost cause to end all lost causes, and which you are not, are you, so hopeless as to hope to defend? You've what? Leopardi for the New Age, miraculous laterite highway, every few miles a clump of vultures, the vile spread, fama, fame, Italian editor, celebrity and hunger gorging on roadkill, a se stesso. Many of the radical maneuvers of Hill's recent poetry are on display here, a notation both dense and rapid, self-interruption, interruption by a fictive busybody of an editor, aggressive challenge to an imagined interlocutor, you've what? Physically repulsive imagery, shifts in register from the colloquial to the complexly rhetorical. Just in these 8 lines, if we wanted to be fancy about it, we could identify 2 figures of speech with solemn names, polypteton, the repetition of a word in different cases or inflections in the same sentence, lost cause, lost causes, you are not, are you, hopeless to hope, and epanalepsis, a figure to which the poet has alerted us back in section 10, the use of the same words to open and close a passage, a se stesso, a se stesso. These figures are neither ornamental nor ostentatious here. In their claustrophobic structure, they embody a fundamental feature of the argument that the lost cause of the self is a lost cause because of its self-enclosure. To confirm the deliberateness of this gesture, we have only to turn back to the earlier invocation of Leopardi in section 61 to find another enclosing epanalepsis and another polypteton, a se stesso, not unworded, n-worded, but in the extremity of coherence, you will be taken up, a se stesso. In fact, if we raise our heads to a wider angled view of the whole poem, we find that it is one large epanalepsis, or almost, with one crucial alteration. It opens in a one-line section that is a descriptive sentence fragment, sun-blazed over Romsley, a livid rain scarp. It concludes in section 150 in almost the same line, sun blazed over Romsley, the livid rain scarp. The intervening 148 sections will have taken us on a wild ride of confession and anti-confession, and will have confronted us with the paradox of a poem that on the one hand accuses the self of being a lost cause, and on the other seems to make the self and its guilt the center of the enterprise. Section 2 reads, "Guilts were incurred in that place. Now I am convinced. Self-molestation of the child's soul, would that be it?" The penultimate section, bracketing the poem and echoing section 5, stretches the arc of the whole from original guilt to the difficulty of forgiveness. "Obstinate old man, senex sapiens, it is not. Is he still writing? What is he writing now? He has just written, 'I find it hard to forgive myself. We are immortal. Where was I?'" Before plunging into this morass of guilt, confession, and paradox, I want to suggest some context for my question about poetic selfhood. First, the modernist doctrine of impersonality. Geoffrey Hill's first two books, For the Unfallen, 1959, and King Log, 1968, hew fairly strictly to a code of non-self-revelation. If the first-person singular pronoun is used at all, it appears as a distanced prophetic I, "Against the burly air I strode," in Genesis, or as an obvious mask, "I love my work and my children. God is distant, difficult," in Ovid in the Third Reich. More often than not, these early poems act through an impersonal we or a fictive you, but most often they operate in the third person. Some have no specified grammatical subject at all. This severity, we may imagine, is in part temperamental hauteur and stoic detachment, and stems in part from the modernist ethos of impersonality, powerfully articulated by T.S. Eliot in his essay Tradition and the Individual Talent in 1919. Quote, "What happens to the artist," Eliot claims, "is a continuous surrender of himself as he is at the moment to something which is more valuable. The progress of an artist is a continual self-sacrifice, a continual extinction of personality." Behind Eliot looms, magus-like, the figure of the French symbolist poet Mallarmé, who declared in his sibylline fashion in Crisis in Verse in 1896, "L'œuvre pure implique la disparition élocutoire du poète." The pure work implies the illocutory disappearance of the poet. At the opposite end of the spectrum from this disappearance flail the paroxysms of self-revelation in what we have come to call confessional poetry. The publication in 1959 of Robert Lowell's Life Studies, itself a masterfully composed work, opened the floodgates to a spate of anecdotal poems of suffering selfhood in which the claim to the reader's attention seemed increasingly to rest not with formal properties of language, but with the sensational personal subject matter. Anne Sexton was one of the early practitioners of this new literalism of the self. Quote, "I hold a 5-year diary that my mother kept for 3 years, telling all she does not say of your alcoholic tendency." She is by no means the worst of the lot, nor has the charm of this irregularly lineated gossip worn off for the public at large. In this context, Hill's project in the later books can be seen as counter-confession, as he savagely asks through the clashing voices of Mertian Hymns, 1971, "What should a man make of remorse that it might profit his soul? Tell me. Tell everything to mother, darling, and God bless." The question is the central one. What should a man or a woman, for that matter, make of remorse? And how do poems make it? One way Hill's poems approach the matter is through a via negativa, the negative way, to use the term of the mystics. "I may be gone some time. Hallelujah! Confession and recantation in the fridge." A later section bursts out, "Incantation or incontinence, the lyric cry. Believe me, he's not told you the half of it. All who are able may stand." For Hill, a Christian poet, confession does not mean self-advertisement. Whether in the fridge or not, confession, as he conceives it, implies a formal relation of the penitent to God. The Confessions of St. Augustine, written in the 4th century CE, set the model. The self of the confessing speaker is composed of an intricate tissue of quotations from the Bible and direct addresses to the Lord. The self takes shape rhetorically through quotation and prayer and assumes self-consciousness in relation to the radical otherness of the divine. This model of confession contrasts sharply with the romantic, self-centering confessions of the 18th century philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who quotes only his own earlier works in a structure of intertextuality I would call auto-erotic, and who addresses the reader for a confirmation of his own reality, uniqueness, and ultimate innocence. With this latter secular form of confession, the one that in debased form dominates our own era of Self magazine, Geoffrey Hill's poems are violently at odds. As for that lyric cry, it is a gauntlet Hill has thrown down several times. The joke on incantation and incontinence in The Triumph of Love in 1998 lit the fuse for the phonetic explosion verging on nonsense in The Orchards of Sion in 2002. Lyric cry, lyric cry, lyric cry, I'll give them lyric cry. Whose is the voice, faint, injured, and ghostly, trapped in this cell phone, if it is not mine? Note the pun on cell phone, self phone. Whose is the voice? That is the matter I am trying to tease out. The lyric poem in the West is generally dated to the Greek poets of the 7th century BCE, Archilochus, Sappho, Alcaeus, among them. In their monodies, songs for single voice accompanied by lyre or flute, these ancient poets seem to have invented a new language for subjectivity, quite different from anything in Homer. We can hear the origin of Hill's lyric cry in Archilochus lamenting, "And I, alone in the dark, I was promised the light." And in Sappho, wrung by erotic desire, describing her own near extinction, "Sweat covers me, trembling seizes me all over. I am paler green than grass. I seem to myself just a little short of dying." I seem to myself, phainomai, the Greek verb, gives the key to this new poetry of the inner life. It is important for us as heirs to Romanticism to recognize that this I, enunciated by Archilochus and Sappho, has some profoundly conventional features, just how many scholars are still arguing about. We should be wary of projecting back on these poets our modern notions of autonomous individuality and of sincerity. We're speaking about a language, a rhetoric for the inner life, about the intensity of this new fictive interiority. To say fictive is not to say false, but it is to insist on the difference between the composed voice and the biographical individual mired in her circumstances and contradictions. After these early Greeks, the lyric cry rolls down the centuries, inflected differently in different eras and languages, but usually saying or pleading or insisting, "I want" and "I hurt." That's what most poems say. In its great forms, it preserves that startling freshness that makes us believe that Catullus and Villon and Baudelaire are our contemporaries and soulmates. I resonates with I. This is not the place for a Cook's tour of Western inwardness. Let me notice a few emblematic instances, however, to show what Hill is rejecting. 5 centuries after Sappho, the Roman poet Catullus addresses himself in poem after poem. "Miser Catulle desinas ineptire, wretched Catullus, stop driveling," he snorts. 1,300 years after Catullus, his fellow Italian Petrarch, inventing the sonnet sequence in the Rime Sparse, balances an intensely personal voice against an elaborate set of Neoplatonic poetic conventions to celebrate his lady, Laura. The very grammar of his first sonnet insists on a hyperbolic inwardness, which is at the same time public. "Ma ben vegi orsi come al popol tutto, favola fui gran tempo, onde sovente di me, medesmo, meco, mi vergogno." You don't have to know Italian to hear all those me. Translation is, "But now I see well how to everyone I was for a long time a public story, for which often of me, myself, within myself, I am ashamed of myself." Hill's procedures in his recent poems and his question, "Whose is the voice?" assault the kind of single self performed by Sappho, Catullus, and Petrarch. In chronology of composition, the books I am considering, and these books are The Triumph of Love, 1998, Speech, Speech, 2000, and The Orchards of Sion of 2002. I propose a specific approach for tracking his adventures of the I. If we inject a radioactive dye into the pronouns and observe their activity, rather as doctors inject dye into patients to observe specific functions of the brain under a CAT scan or MRI, we will not obtain a comprehensive account of these poems, but we will have an insight about one of their central concerns. How does the self grow capable of redemptive love? Poetry is neither philosophy, nor psychology, nor theology. It arrives at its truths through a musical verbal process, cadence leading to cadence, clause to clause, in the compromised, slipshod medium of language. Hill's process is more exacting than most, more purgatorial, dragging through pain, obscenity, curse, question, argument, solecism, and deliberate misprision, to prayer and guarded blessing. In this labor, his pronouns do much of the heavy lifting. "Excuse me," blurts his shifting speaker in the triumph of love. "Excuse me, excuse me. I did not say the pain is lifting. I said the pain is in the lifting. No, please, forget it." In considering personal pronouns as the actors in the drama, let's turn for a moment to the linguist Emile Benveniste. He sets the first and second grammatical persons, I and you, in a totally different category from the third person, he, she, it. I and you, according to Benveniste, are not referential nouns. They refer to no fixed or objective notion. He says each I has its own referent and corresponds each time to the unique being who is set up as such. I cannot be defined except in terms of locution, that means the act of speaking, not in terms of objects. I signifies only the person who is uttering the present in this moment of discourse containing I. It has no value except in the instance in which it is produced. That's Benveniste's rather clinical vocabulary. The same goes, of course, for you. Benveniste says of I and you that their job is to solve the problem of what he calls intersubjective communication. Language has solved the problem, he argues, by creating an ensemble of empty signs that are non-referentia with respect to reality. These signs are always available and become full as soon as a speaker introduces them into each instance of discourse. Language may have, quote, solved the problem of intersubjective communication, rebarbative phrase, in some abstract way, but we mortals need to solve it again and again in action. And that is what the pronouns strain to do in Hill's late poetry. The strain emerges partly from the fact that Hill's pronouns are, if not empty signs, signs that shift their reference with almost every enunciation. No I, no you, no we can be trusted to remain the same in the course of even a short passage in these poems. And the struggle to track them, the reader is jarred into an uncomfortable, radicalized vision of selfhood and its relations. To complement Benveniste, let us draw into the orbit of our reading the name of the French philosopher Emmanuel Levinas. Benveniste's analysis would leave us with the exhilarating notion of an I as an empty sign, but Levinas's religious perspective from his Jewish tradition builds off Martin Buber's classic work I and Thou of 1923 and Gabriel Marcel's Metaphysical Journal, 1927, to emphasize more dynamically the relations between I and you. We need such an emphasis in reading Hill, whose long poems are both erotic and theological. To say you, writes Levinas, is the primary fact of saying. He meditates upon the mystery of distance and intimacy between I and you, what he calls the marvel of the social relation. Behind that marvel stands for him, as for Buber, the greater marvel of a God who sums up the possibility of all human connectedness. We now have a context in which to approach Hill's Adventures of the I. Years ago, he was composing occult autobiographies, as in the songbook of Sebastian Araruth in King Log and in Mercian Hymns. The persona of Araruth, an imaginary Spanish poet, freed Hill to write an erotic sequence in which I and you emerge in a numinous directness he had not otherwise allowed himself. One cannot lose what one has not possessed. So much for that abrasive gem. I can lose what I want. I want you. In the multiple exposure of personae in Mercian Hymns, the 8th century Anglo-Saxon king Offa is crossed with a 20th century boy. Dreamy, smug-faced, sick on outings, I who was taken to be a king of some kind, a prodigy, a maimed one. It was from Mercian Hymns that I lifted the challenge, what should a man make of remorse? And in the dance of I and he in the hymns, we find a dry run for the phantasmagorical pronouns of the late work. We face a paradox. In these long poems, as Hill leaves behind the subjective genre of lyric, he allows in far more unruly autobiography. The voices fracture and multiply, and the lines already disarticulated in many of the poems in Canaan, 1996, devolve further from metrical order to a subtle, frequently enjambed free verse. Two more observations. In these long poems, Hill uses polyphony, multiple voices as a discipline and a method of inquiry and transformation. Part of the discipline is the task of integrating a poetry of private confession and quest for absolution within a poetry of public ethical discourse. Now let's watch some poetry at work. The Triumph of Love, whose 150 sections pay homage to the 150 Psalms, starts teasingly with five sections, coordinating the number of lines in each section to the section number. After the fifth section, the symmetry peters out, and we are already over our heads in the deep end. The first line abstains in several ways. Sun blazed over Romsley, a livid rain scarp. It is not a full sentence, and it has no pronouns, no human actors. Dense with two noun compounds, which are metrically two emphatic spondees, sun blazed, rain scarp, it sets us in a highly visual landscape. Even without a verb, the line acts. It plays opposites against one another, sun against rain, blaze against blue-black of livid, celebration in sun against harm, livid, the bruise color. Scarp itself is an aggressive word, meaning the pitch of a hill, but also a fortified bank. Along with the destructive possibilities in blaze, scarp charges the line with contained force. And what of the keystone, the name Romsley? Readers unfamiliar with Hill's native Worcestershire in England won't have to look far to discover that Romsley is a town close to Bromsgrove, where Hill was born. So we find ourselves in an obscurely autobiographical landscape, both personal and impersonal. No I, but the land itself, eloquent with mute personal history, brilliant and bruised. Section 2 thickens the plot. Guilts were incurred in that place. Now I am convinced. Self-molestation of the child's soul, would that be it? Guilts were incurred. By whom? That is one mystery the whole rest of the poem will try to solve. Guilt for the death of Kenelm, the boy martyr murdered there in the 9th century, we learn in section 7. Diffuse guilt for the dead of World War II. Personal guilts never directly confessed, but requiring the whole poem's purgatorial labor. Then the first person singular enters. Now I am convinced. This I purports to be a center of consciousness and judgment in the poem. We shall see how soon he is dislodged. Now suggests a present vantage point for surveying the past, a bifocal vision confirmed in the next line, self-molestation of the child's soul, which brings child and the adult I into alignment. Almost at its conclusion, in section 121, the poem will pick up this motif of doubled vision, child-adult, as it imagines a source of redemption in childhood innocence. Light is this instant, far-seeing into itself, its own signature on things that recognize salvation. I am an old man, a child. The horizon is Traherne's country. Thomas Traherne, you will remember, is the English 17th century poet of landscapes of visionary innocence. But in the early stages of the Triumph of Love, childhood is felt as a source of guilt, not innocence. The poem will have far to go before it redeems that child. Section 3 responds to the challenge of diffuse guilt, what in Christian terms we could feel as original sin. Patronius Arbiter, take us in charge. Carry us with you to the house of correction. Angelus Silesius, guard us while we are there. Two guardians are invoked, Patronius Arbiter, the Roman author of the wildly decadent novel The Satyricon from the reign of Nero, and Angelus Silesius, a 17th century Polish Lutheran poet and doctor who converted to Roman Catholicism. The name of Patronius warns us that the poem will engage in violent public corruption. The appeal to Angelus Silesius suggests the opposite extreme, a luminous caritas. The arc of Hill's triumph, triumph in the sense not of victory, but of a ceremonial procession, will extend, we may imagine, from perversion to sacred love, from public satire to private blessing. Observing our radioactive dye, note the expanding scope of the poem. No pronouns in section 1, then we get a first-person singular in section 2, and now the first-person plural, take us in charge. This move to we and us is crucial. It signals an intention to integrate the solitary self into some larger communal experience of suffering and purgation. Section 4 withdraws to the impersonal with an oblique description of the poem's process, ever more protracted foreplay. But it is to section 5 I want to draw your attention. It contains in Nietzsche the purgatorial method of the whole work and the alternative model to the lost cause of the self. Obstinate old man, Senex sapiens, it is not. What is he saying? Why is he still so angry? He says, I cannot forgive myself. We are immortal. Where was I? Prick him. Senex sapiens is the Latin for the stock figure of the wise old man. No quotation marks cordon off these statements or help us distinguish the voices. What the poem calls for much later, a formal self-distancing, is already at work in this third-person portrait of the obstinate old man. A hostile public voice seems to launch this attack and registers the incomprehension of so many of Hill's critics. Why is he still so angry? But the kaleidoscope turns quickly, and the pronouns tumble into and over one another. It, he, I, myself, we, I, him. Who is this we of we are immortal? Is the statement contained in what he says, or is it some general claim by an authorial voice from an Archimedean point outside the dialogue? Who asks, where was I? We cannot definitively answer such questions. The poem has thrown us into a quest for self-definition that involves guilt. I cannot forgive myself. A religious promise of immortality. A first-person singular who appears mobile and changeable. Where was I? And an inimical relation to a public world. Prick him. By the end of the poem, the wheel of 145 sections will have brought us round again to a version of this passage, significantly changed. But we are not there yet. The Triumph of Love is a long poem. We will find juxtaposed throughout it the kaleidoscope shards we saw in section 5. For instance, we could make a list of the third-person portraits of the author. Scab-picking old scab. Why should we be salted with the scurf of his sores? Obnoxious, chthonic old fart. Shameless old man. Rancorous, narcissistic old sod. This is the poet seen by his public. At another extreme are the intimate enunciations of I musing in solitude. Why do I take as my gift a wounded and wounding introspection? And of Romsley, let it now take for good a bad part of my childhood. I gather I was a real swine. The problem is one of integration. How can we as readers, how can the poem, relate the intimate confessing self to this self seen contemptuously from the outside? This is where Benveniste, in spite of his clinical vocabulary, comes usefully to hand. If we think of I and you not as referring to stable entities, but as signs waiting to be filled with the meaning of each encounter, then we will begin to have a sense of the cumulative, plural way in which the triumph of love works. Bearing in mind as well Levinas's sense of I and you as filling each other with reciprocal meaning, we might look to the I-you constructions in the poem for forms in which a self capable of love takes shape. The work's title is, after all, The Triumph of Love. A scan of the I-you passages reveals three main types, the intimate, my dear and awkward love, we may not need to burn the furniture, the embattled, bugger you, Mexicker, et al., and the prayers to Petrarch's Vergine Bella, lovely virgin, interspersed throughout. The I that asks in the penultimate section, where was I, has taken shape through all these encounters and more. It is largely composed, for instance, by its capacity for memory and mourning, processes not so easily picked up by scanning pronouns, but central to the poem. Whose lives are hidden in God? Whose? Asks the unnamed speaker urgently about the dead of World War II. And images of the war, the burning ghetto in film and stills, Coventry in huge silent whoomps of flame shadow, have in some sense set the terms for the need for purgation that drives the poem. That it is a process and driven, we are never in doubt, though it proceeds by editorial interruption, doublings back, and ironic non sequiturs, and though halfway through the author I appears lost in this maze of my own devising. The procession, enjoying its own form of epanalepsis, fetches up almost where it began. Obstinate old man, Senex sapiens, it is not. Is he still writing? What is he writing now? He has just written, I find it hard to forgive myself. We are immortal. Where was I? The obstinate old man is now writing, not saying, you will have observed. The act is now in the perfect tense. He has just written. What he has just written is the entire poem we have just read. And here is its synopsis. Instead of, I cannot forgive myself, we have arrived at, I find it hard to forgive myself. The forgiveness is difficult, but to the eye of faith, it is as improbably possible as that Gerard Manley Hopkins, Jack Joke, poor potsherd, patch, matchwood self should be simultaneously in Christ's love, immortal diamond. We are immortal, claims, not so much the poet as the poem. It is a collective, not a private statement. The jolt back to the personal question, where was I, given new point by the altered line break, has the quality of waking from a dream and delivers us back almost to our point of origin. Sun-blazed over Romsley, the livid rain scarp. Not now a rain scarp, but the rain scarp, the one known, recognized, made particular. An origin now, not only for the poet, but for the reader who has shared in the trek. One answer to the question, where was I, is not in the solitary self, for there is no such thing for true being, but in place, in time, in a set of relations. We can do no more than glance at speech and the orchards of Sion, but a similar attention to the adventures of I with you and he would show us a good deal about confession in these works. Speech, the infernal canticle, welters in a stew of jargon and abused language. Ferocious humor, a harsh sexuality of checkmate condoms, exchange of love bites, the urine ceremony. This is hell, after all. In this cacophony of crossed signals, I am losing you, the poetic self pursues its pilgrimage, though authentic self, a stinker, is the message to pass on. This burlesque show, gruesomely public and interrupted by laughter and applause, drops even the consoling support of the shared plural. On self-advisement, I erased we, though I is a shade too painful. A telescopic view of this wild poem, speech, shows that once again the mathematical center provides a clue to its progress in goals. Midway through the 120 sections, as many as the days that were of Sodom, 120, section 60, which you have, takes stock of its own pilgrim's progress. I'll read it. I think now I shall get through, even a bit of a breather, nothing heavy, no heavy come on thy way, friend. Up the hill, difficulty, how do I find thee? That's a good name, Apollyon. Too many stuck for a treatise, maybe, but so what? Sister perversity, anon on his knees, sinuses choked with shit. Is there anyone not a promoter of simple gifts? Keep with it, pilgrim, no more 9 days wonder. Cambridge, full of thy learning, flash, Bucer signs for England, De Regno Christi. We can treat this passage as a microcosm. The apparently authorial confessional I think now I shall get through, is no sooner proposed than he's boxed on the ears into the second person, on thy way, friend, and then estranged into an allegorical landscape in the outrageous pun, up the hill difficulty. The impudent pun, of course, thumbs its nose at the by now ritualized criticism of Hill's work as difficult, inaccessible. The question, how do I find thee, explodes any unitary pretensions of the initial I. This I feels plural. It echoes Bunyan, author of Pilgrim's Progress. It incorporates but surpasses the authorial voice. It seeks a thee. The proper noun, Hill, has fractured into two pronouns, I and thee. Hill, in search of himself. But what he finds is a demonic joke, a parody of poetry's investiture. Where we had a right to expect Apollo, the god of harmony, we receive Apollyon, the angel of the abyss, in the book of Revelations. And that persona degenerates phonetically and symbolically to a non-entity, Anon, on his knees, sinuses choked with shit. The section doesn't leave us in Dantesque scatology, however. It is a measure of Hill's great distance from the postmodern free play of pronouns in John Ashbery, for instance, that from this wreckage of I, this section rescues the figure of Pilgrim, and concludes in a theological news bulletin, flash, Bucer signs for England, De Regno Christi. The decomposed isolate self in Hill opens up to a vision, borrowed from the 15th century Protestant theologian Martin Bucer, who took refuge in Cambridge, of selfhood formed in relation to national and divine orders. Speech concludes its slapstick phonetic nonsense, which scrambles all the concludes its slapstick with phonetic nonsense, which scrambles all the poem's themes. Love, consciousness, identity, prayer, amor, man in a coma, mam, nemo, amen. This is Hill's hell. We are hardly to expect a redemptive promise. At best, its paronomasia and freakish juxtapositions serve the purpose of voiding bad sense. It is left to his paradiso, the orchards of Sion, to cash the checks written here by the words amor, love, and amen. Taking one of its many cues from Calderon's 17th century play, Life is a Dream, The Orchards of Sion, the most recent book, integrates confession with profession of faith, nature's cycles with God's time, eros with caritas, and the eye with vastly larger orders of spirit and sense. Its method is relational. Through the medium of its gently loping cadences, swift elisions, multiple exposures, its modes are pastoral and theatrical, both announced in the opening poem, which celebrates illusionistic play. Watch my hands confabulate their shadowed rhetoric. As we have come to expect, I and you engage in an elaborate dance which translates them to the impersonal form of patterned action. Tell me, is this the way to the orchards of Sion, where I left you thinking I would return? The eye still has tricks up its sleeve, some of them confessional. Quote, I wish I understood myself more clearly or less well. And I know breakthrough as I tell the dream surpassed. Seen alone, I is a lost cause. It will be the poem's task, as it was Dante's in the Vita Nuova and Petrarch's in the Rime Sparse, to absorb the private eye through erotic experience into nuptials of the spirit. Its analogous task is to assimilate Bromsgrove, the town of personal origin, to Golden Grove, Hopkins' mythically mortal wood, and to absorb Golden Grove in its turn to the higher biblical pastoral of the Orchards of Sion, a sacred and timeless order, the true home. Autobiography is to be sublimed into collective sacred myth. The poem moves through a panoply of intimacies between shifting eyes and yous. Some are remembered lovers, some are fellow writers invoked as guardian spirits. I will conclude by reading one poem from The Orchards. Behind poem 55 stands Shakespeare's Twelfth Night with its plots of disguises and crossed loves. The I and you in the poem are both seen as actors. Malvolio, the abused clown, Viola, the disguised heroine. Identity is understood as emerging through the play of illusion, the self-surmounting roles, and is composed in the structure of the relationship, to you I stand answerable. In its graceful, flexible pentameters, the poem moves through confession to various senses of profession, the compromised senses of profession as a job, or even as a dubious claim, I profess to something or other, to make room for something like a profession of faith. Love leads, but the eye drops out by the last lines to make room for withdrawn theology. God, the ultimate source of being and relationship, is understood as hidden, even absent, but remains the primary motive force in his creatures in whom he leaves desire. With lovely tact, the poem ends with the sun dropping below the hill, Anchordine, as God himself has dropped from view, but not from power. Section 55 does not conclude the book, The Orchards of Sion, but it is here that I wish to wind up my account. The self alone, in Hill's view, is a lost cause, but that is the beginning, not the end of the story. His Dantesque trilogy provides a structure in which the self can be imagined as rescued. Despite the hallucinatory method, a deep and orderly logic is asserted in the architecture of each of the canticles. The lost self gathers substance in the struggle to consciousness, in a series of relationships which emerge rhythmically to include the dead, an ideal of nation, and God. The poems are, in the fullest sense, comic. Nothi se auton sounds like adult fun, Section 37 had wisecracked about the Socratic injunction, Nothi se auton, know thyself. And the poems are, among other things, at least I think they are, fiendishly funny. But they are divine comedies as well, in Dante's mode, commedia, because they end happily. The poem reads, I desire so not to deny desires intransigence. To you I stand answerable. Correction, must once have stood. What's this thing like a clown's eyebrow brush? Oh, my lady, it is the fool's confession, weeping grease paint, all paint and rhetoric. Empower the muse, I'm tired. Shakespeare, who scarcely brooded on perfection, perfect so many times. Memory, memory. The eye elaborates its tears, but misremembered. Misremembering no less key-clustered mistletoe, the orchard's chatelaine. I may well carry my three engraved thoughts out beyond Shrawley, whose broad verges once throve like spare garden plots with pear and apple, or with wild damson thinner on the ground. Oh, my lady, this is a fool's profession, and you may be dead, or with Alzheimer's, or happily still adoring a different Duke of Illyria. I have set you up, I confess that, so as not to stint your voice of justice. Love grows in some way closer to withdrawn theology. The deist's orb drops below Anchordine. Thank you.
The Triumph of Love, you very rightly, no doubt correctly, pointed out the passage of the obstinate old man reflecting on his youth. I saw it in a different way, and I wonder if I might offer it to you for your comment. I saw it, for example, in 5, I saw the emphasis on Senex sapiens, and in 149, Senex sapiens, as in a sense contrasting what he started with, what was Homo sapiens. Mm. And that at the end, when he was saying, where was I, it wasn't that he was reflecting on his past, but that his mind was wandering. Oh, where was I? Where was I? Oh, prick him. Yes. Wake him up.
Yes.
And it wasn't so much memory and mourning, it was incipient senescence that I saw. I wonder if that somehow changes one's view.
Hans, I think you're absolutely right to hear those colloquial inflections there. For me, it doesn't change how I see it, but it is part of the layering. And I think that any line of hills that you go into, you can start hearing multiple echoes and resonances, which if I had tried to start charting all of them, we would have been here for 50 hours rather than one. But I think you're the process that you're engaged in, like teasing out the puns within Amen and Nemo and Omen and Ma'am, and the process here of hearing the colloquial wandering mind, where was I, is precisely the right process for reading Hill. He invites it. He invites a kind of hallucinatory proliferation of possible meanings. But I think that the important point is not to conclude from that everything is meaningless, as certain kinds of postmodern poetry do celebrate a kind of promiscuous, endlessly proliferating meaninglessness. I think Hill has a very strict logic, a theological logic, finally, behind this enterprise of the temporary meaninglessness in which we find ourselves.
Thank you. Yeah. Sure. My question was concerning what you had said about the linguist. I forget the name of the linguist, but that the pronouns I and you are different from he and she, and that they only have a meaning when they are spoken in discourse. I was wondering in Hill's poetry how he uses that, so that each time he uses the words I and you, they have a different meaning for him. Nietzsche stands? Like, how does he use that idea in his poetry?
Well, I think that maybe the key word is action. And I would emphasize, too, the way in which theater is so important to Hill. I hope you could hear a little bit in the way I read aloud that it's all a kind of either burlesque show or Shakespearean drama going on. So the question of the voice as actor is very important. So the I, especially in the section 5 of The Triumph of Love, which we looked at, which is reformed, deformed in section 149, because there are no quotation marks, we can't really tell what is the exact province of I and what's the exact province of he. We have, he says, comma, I cannot forgive myself, we are immortal. And there's just no way to tell whether that we is who it refers to exactly. And all through the poem, some of the sections I tried to show you or read to you had this multiple possibilities of interpretation of what we could impose upon the I. Oh, I think this is the poet speaking, or I think this is the child speaking, or I think this is the theologian speaking. But as Professor Kornberg was pointing out, there are always multiple and ambiguous other possibilities proliferating. Hill is deliberately disorienting us. I think that's my point. Other writers would have made it clear, and often your teachers of rhetoric will ask you to make it clear who's speaking. Hill is making it unclear, and he's doing it deliberately. You could say it's perverse.
I have more of a general comment. I noticed before something that you said, and it was sort of intriguing, how, and I wasn't sure whether you considered this, like, universally for all of poetry, but you said, I'm not sure whether you're referring to Hill or any of, you know, the famous authors you were talking about, but you said that poetry, it's not philosophy, it's not psychology, it's not theology. Rather, it's a sort of verbal music, and you said it's that language is compromised, slipshod. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that. Do you think that poetry is sort of like... I mean, obviously, it's not an exercise in futility, but you consider it a sort of fumbling search? Or how clumsy or how imperfect or compromised do you take language in poetry?
Mm. Of course, it depends on the poet. Some poets use the promiscuous, dangerous, slippy possibilities of language more than others do. Shakespeare does all the time. Touch any word in Shakespeare and it will start bleeding into other senses. It's very hard to control them. And Hill is one of the poets who, more than most, decides instead of trying to affirm and enact a rigid clarity, a strict containment of clear unitary meanings, he goes the opposite direction. He says, I accept that the condition of language is to be mistaken, or to use the Christian term, since Hill is a Christian poet, lapsed, fallen language, post-Babel language, that meanings are flying out of our control. He accepts that possible delirium tremens of language and works through it to, I would say, a dynamic relational model of groping toward truth, struggling toward truth. When I spoke about poetry not being theology or psychology or philosophy, I mean that it advances. I spoke of the poems as having an arc. You know, they start from A and they go however far they go. But they trace that arc, that action. And if we're really reading, we are involved as readers in that action through poetry's own means, which are multiple. And you can feel them, some of them just physiologically, poetry moves, it should throb, it responds to the complex rhythms of human consciousness, not only our heartbeat, but all the different kinds of counterpointed rhythms of consciousness in electromagnetic brain waves, about which Dr. Kornberg can tell you more than I can. But I'm simply aware that we are a bundle of competing rhythms. That's what human consciousness is. Poetry, dance, song, translate those multiple rhythms into formal structures of understanding. How else does poetry work in its own slipshod way? Well, through images, which means appeal to the imagination. It's a primitive language, poetry. It works a lot of it subliminally, calling up feelings of sensations of color, smell, texture, touch, anxiety that we could hardly even put into articulate more abstract language until we really made an analytic exercise of it. I've spoken of rhythm, of imagery, and then there's the question of, let us say, the physicality of vowels and consonants, the way a truly charged poetic line, as opposed to a dead line, will have the vowels jostling, you could almost say tickling and striking each other. Just for an example, let me quote you a line I love from the American poet Hart Crane for its vowel values. Bind us in time, O seasons clear, and awe. Before you even translate that semantically in terms of dictionary meanings, I hope you know one is aware of being brought through a journey of sounds. And then the mind, the rational mind, starts operating in all these subliminal ways, and we get out our dictionaries, and we have the realm of semantics, which is assigned meanings, denotation and connotation. And then there's syntax, which is a fabulously expressive medium, which the 20th century has somewhat neglected, the force of grammar, of how do nouns become subjects and how do verbs become the locomotive. That's a form of meaning, too, and it's all playing together. Amazingly complex. So has anyone ever tried to teach you how to dance or kiss someone? You could have a handbook, but that's not really how you learn it. Yeah. Thank you.
University professor and poet Rosanna Warren on Adventures of the I, the Poetry of Pronouns. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Largy with help from John Perotti and Glenn Alexander. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.
Tomorrow on The Connection, in the first hour, Iraq's most influential Shiite cleric calls for open elections, exacerbating ethnic tensions and causing some to fear the worst. In the second hour, human rights scholar Michael Ignatieff on the line between fact and fiction when the subject is wartime atrocities. I'm Gail Harris. Join us tomorrow starting at 10 on The Connection from 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
This is WBUR. Coming up ahead at 10 o'clock after the news, it's part five of the special BBC special, White in Africa. Travel with Sylvia Poggioli this summer on our next Citizens of the World tour to Italy. Stops include Florence, Tuscany, and the Italian Riviera.